It's Sunday, January 14th, 2007. Industry Misinterpretations was recorded yesterday, Saturday, January 13th, at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. We had Michael Lucas Smith, James Robertson, David Buck, and Bryce Campcheese on the line with David Griswold, the Strong Talk guy, as some people call him. He was part of the development team that developed Strong Talk back in 1994, 1995. We had a long conversation with him about the history of Strong Talk and where the system is today and how open sourcing has affected it. Hope you enjoy the podcast. Talk was very enjoyable.
Darling, I gotta talk to you about the things you've been putting me through now. I gotta talk to you, I gotta be explained to you.
Well, so what we have on the line is me, James Robertson. We've got Dave Griswold. And Dave, why don't you, I'm not even sure who you're working for or where you're working now, so why don't you go ahead and introduce that?
Well, I'm actually working on my own right now, not even doing small talk, doing just sort of fundamental research, playing with languages and things like that. Nothing worth talking about yet. It's better to produce something before touting it. This sort of, you know, came out of the blue with Strong Talk being released, so this has been kind of a part-time effort with Strong Talk, but it's nice to get back into the small talk community.
Okay, and we've got Bryce Campcheese on the line. We've had you on before. You're we like to call you the Exupery guy.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I'm probably mispronouncing that.
Exupery.
So you're located in England, so it's pretty late there now, right?
It's not that late. It's only about 9:10.
Okay. Well, that's not bad.
So it's still pleasant.
Okay, and Michael, you're on the other side of the planet.
And Michael had to get up early on Sunday?
Yeah, it's 8 a.m. right now. It's not too early. It's pretty good. Sun's up. It's shining.
I know I'm not the best at 8 a.m. on a Sunday morning.
No, 8 a.m. tomorrow morning, I'm hoping to be asleep.
So am I.
All right, so David, why don't you give us a background on where Strong Talk came from so that we have grounding for what we're going to talk about.
Sure. It's got kind of an unusual history compared to most open source projects. Quite a long history at this point, starting back in, I don't know the exact year, but late 80s. It was the outcome of several different lines of work. One was, well, the primary motivation was, I think, similar to Bryce's, which is a feeling that Smalltalk just needs to be faster. Back at that point, I was using Park Place Smalltalk at that point before it was Syncom. And we were working towards producing a back-end for, Elliot Moss has a garbage-collected enabled back-end for GCC, and so originally we developed a type system called StrongTalk, which I should differentiate from the virtual machine. So we developed the type system in the hopes of eventually having a back-end that would use something like GCC with a garbage collector for performance. But as we got into it and the type system developed and we decided to do type system that was based on pure interfaces as opposed to implementation types, it became clear that the type system by itself was kind of separate from VM performance issues. So that kind of branched off into two lines of work. So the first time people heard about Strong Talk was in 93 when we published the paper on the type system. At that point, there was not a virtual machine or any performance technology for Strong Talk. It was, you know, leading up to that work eventually, but at that point it was just a preprocessor on top of Park Place. And then at that point we hooked up with Urs at the Self project, and finally the two different lines of work came together, and he had much better technology, so rather than having to use, you know, a more traditional compiler back end and then struggle to build all the, you know, dynamic reflective capabilities that Strong Talk people are used to, we were able to start with what was basically a derivative of the Self VM, which already had all those capabilities built in and gave us a much nicer, more traditional small talk kind of look and feel to the system. And so then it turned into a startup out here in 94 was when that started. And we had seven guys, and we worked kind of in secret on that because we didn't want anyone else to know what we were doing, although it turned out type feedback is intimidating enough that we didn't need to worry too much about competitors, I don't think.
When you started that, when word did leak out, I remember I was a sales engineer at Park Place at the time, and there was something resembling panic in the halls at Park Place over the existence of that project.
Oh, interesting. Well, I would have loved to have Park Place do the stuff, too, and, you know, basically I'm just a guy who likes small talk and wanted it to be fast for the kind of applications I was running. We just really, really wanted to see that happen, and you know, it's always been my view that that would be something that would help small talk in the market.
What kind of applications were you running at the time?
I was working on Wall Street for Goldman Sachs originally, and then that work branched off to contracting work for Bankers Trust. I had a little company in New York, and it was our company in conjunction with a guy I had met at Goldman Sachs that funded the development of Strong Talk. And then once we got out here, you know, we had the system going pretty nicely, and you know, the system was all coming together. Basically, it was in the state that you see it in now, since you know, development effectively froze at that point. And then Java came out, and everyone knows the storm that Java created in the market. And simply as a sort of corporate direction thing, as we all know, things don't always go the direction you want them to in terms of software preferences. So we ended up working on Java and developing a Java VM that used the same type feedback technology. Since it wasn't looking
too great.
That was
the one at Sun, right?
Well, we produced that as a startup and then went to Sun and were acquired by them. And then that became what is now the hotspot virtual machine at Sun. So then Strong Talk sat on a shelf. So this is why it's such a strange history. You know, this was a very advanced technology 10, 15 years ago, long time in software terms. And then the Java VM happened and all the history of Java and the market and et cetera, et cetera. And now suddenly, out of the distant past, the Sun has finally, you know, enough time has passed, I think, that they felt comfortable releasing Strong Talk and not feeling like it would be a threat to Java or anything like that, which I don't think they have to fear too much at this point.
Well, didn't StrongTalk have to be changed fairly significantly to work on the JVM anyway? I mean, some of the optimization stuff you were doing was fairly well tuned to a dynamic language, and they had to make modifications to get that to be useful for Java, didn't they?
Absolutely. Well, there are really two different VMs, although the Java VM did start from the StrongTalk VM, but we didn't you know, take the SmallTalk VM and slowly morph it into a Java VM. We, you know, looked at it on the one hand and then produced a new virtual machine for Java that was designed for that language. I mean, the languages are very different, as you're pointing out. In Java, you do have, you know, manifest type information, implementation type information that the compiler can use to drive optimization, which was not there in Smalltalk, not even with our type system, since that was a pure interface type system. And so, you know, you've got unboxed integers and all these sort of things that, you know, you can run super blazing fast, even though they're less flexible. And so we really needed to revamp the VM all the way down to the bare metal, pretty much. As a matter of fact, the Java VM, as far as I know, they does not actually use type feedback. It uses other inlining techniques. It does use, you know, lazy optimization and all the kinds of de-optimization tricks that StrongTalk used. But the inlining itself is driven more by the type system as opposed to by type feedback-based information.
The type system in StrongTalk really wasn't involved in the performance at all, was it?
Well, we did start off that way, but as many people who've looked at type systems have noted, if you tie them to implementation types, you lose a lot of flexibility. But if you don't tie them to implementation types, then you lose the ability to optimize. And so there's kind of a nasty trade-off there. We feel like we ended up with something that worked out extraordinarily well, because we ended up with two totally independent components, an interface-based type system that didn't have the drawbacks of implementation types, and type feedback, which gave us even better optimization than we could do with the type system. And the two, because they're independent of each other, worked really, really well together.
Could you explain this type feedback optimization that you've been talking about?
Yes, this was Urs Holzle's technology that he developed for his thesis at Stanford for the self virtual machine. And it was really, I think, the first real breakthrough in...
It was the big breakthrough after about 84, the Deutsch Schiffman machine.
Exactly. That was the first real functioning compiler. You know, it's interesting that you can look at the way the Deutsch Schiffman compiler works, and you can see that they struggled with many of the same issues that we're struggled with, one of which is code size for something like Smalltalk. And so it uses, for example, a code cache as opposed to you know, just keeping a hold of everything that's ever been compiled. And you know, that's a different approach, but coming from the same idea of worrying about code size, whereas type feedback is based on lazy compilation. Rather than compiling eagerly but just keeping around a working set, it keeps everything it compiles, but it compiles lazily so that you only compile the things you absolutely have to. But it makes it a lot more complicated because you have to have a mix of interpreted and compiled code.
Didn't the original self stuff just compile without an interpreter?
You mean self?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's one of the areas where StrongTalk was an advance over the self virtual machine, because we were able to start over again and really target it towards Smalltalk and learn from the first generation of the type feedback technology for self. We had a number of members of the self team, you know, in our company, and so they were able to say, hey, this is what we didn't like or did like about the self virtual machine. And the way the self virtual machine worked was it had a non-inlining compiler that was the first pass rather than an interpreter. And so it had two different compilers, a non-inlining compiler and an inlining compiler. And sure enough, just as I was pointing out in terms of the size issue, the non-inlining compiler turned out to be a big mistake because it produced enormously verbose code. As anybody who's dealt with compilers knows, optimized code is more compact than unoptimized code. And if you can't do inlining, you end up with a ton of different versions of methods because of customization. And so the non-inlining compiler produced enormous amounts of code that wasn't used very often, so it really didn't make any sense. There was no reason to compile it in the first place since it was uncommonly used code. And so in StrongTalk, we tossed out the non-inlining compiler and then designed the system to work with mixed compiled and interpreted code, which took a fair amount of complexity, but also means that we have a beautifully small working set now. I remember when we were first looking at it, you know, just to boot it up, we used over 64 mega memory. And most of
which
that
is
was because...
nothing now.
No, that's true, but it wasn't used for anything useful. If you're going to use it for something you need, some data structures or icons or whatever it is you're going to use in memory, that's fine. But it was just on wasted space for the non-inlining compiled code. So you had all this code that was using all this space and was hardly ever used, and an interpreter would be just as good for that sort of code. And so with StrongTalk, you can boot up, and you rarely have a code, you know, cache of more than about 3 or 4 megabytes. The whole heap is the whole image size ends up being around 15, 16 megabytes, which is, you know, actual real data on your heap.
Now, is that the primary reason that self used to chew as much memory as it did? As I recall, one of the drawbacks of self early on was that relative to the time, it was an absolutely enormous memory constraint kind of thing.
Right. And I think that's actually been fixed since then. I don't think the self machine, I haven't looked at the self source code in quite a while. I do know that somebody was telling me that there's been a version of the self machine that's been produced by somebody, I don't know how advanced it is, that has an interpreter instead of the non-inlining compiler. So obviously other people have noticed that issue as well.
Your company owned the self code as well before going to Sun?
No, in fact, the self source code was open source. You know, it was one of the first open source things out there in the Smalltalk community. You know, it was under, I believe, what was effectively a Berkeley license. So it was freely usable for commercial purposes, and nobody else was using it. So since we had some people from the self team and we had the source code, we were able to proceed without having to have any kind of ownership.
Hi, my apologies. I'm a bit late getting in. Dave Buck here.
David's been explaining to us how the background of StrongTalk and going through a few questions, mostly from Michael and David. As I've said before, when we discussed Exupery, I pretty much shut up on that call because it was mostly outside my range. So I'm letting the rest of you guys talk since I've already told you more about BMs than I know.
Well, somebody did ask me how type feedback worked there, and I didn't give an actual complete answer to that question. So is there any interest in me continuing with that or some other question?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, that'd be good.
There's plenty of information out there about how type feedback works, and it's a, you know, pretty sophisticated technology to describe off the top of your head.
It's also very well documented in the self paper, so if anybody wants more detail later, they're well worth chasing.
That's right. On the StrongTalk website, there's also, under the documentation, there's pointers to the important papers from Worse and the self team where that technology was originated. And, of course, obviously the self site has those too. Type feedback is a little bit of a misnomer. You shouldn't really think of it in terms of StrongTalk as using the word type. It's especially confusing since StrongTalk has a type system, which is not the same types that the type feedback itself is measuring. So separate those out. When you hear type feedback, you should really hear class feedback is really the right way to think about it in Smalltalk. The basic idea is you want to be able to inline code. The reason why no one's ever been able to make StrongTalk that much faster before, and the reason why this was a big breakthrough, that this technology of Worse's, was that StrongTalk has a much higher call frequency than most languages, including Java. You know, since everything
is StrongTalk or SmallTalk at this point.
I should say any kind of SmallTalk, including StrongTalk. The thing that makes SmallTalk so powerful is that everything is an object and everything is a message send, and that's where you get all this incredible capability to write your own control structures and deal with integers and other things polymorphically, and all those things that SmallTalk lovers and dynamic language lovers, you know, really want. And especially since the control structures are, you know, semantically messages, that means every single little thing you're doing, adding two numbers or, you know, sending if then else or whatever, is at least at the semantic level a message send. And so trying to optimize that is extraordinarily hard, because if you actually have to make a call every few instructions, then it's very hard for a compiler to do a good job optimizing. And that was really the bottleneck that people had struggled with before, is you can generate all the good code you want, but if you only have five instructions before the next call, then there's not much you can do. And so what type feedback did was it said, hey, let's run it in the interpreter first and use a technique called polymorphic inline caches, which basically just means recording the different kinds of classes, receiver classes that occur at each call site. It's just a list associated with each call site. You note that, you know, after you run the program a little bit, that the vast majority of sends, even though they could be polymorphic, don't in fact use more than one receiver type. You know, when you're adding two numbers together, usually you're adding an integer to an integer. Now, they could be doubles. One could be a double and one could be an integer, and you could get polymorphism there, but usually that doesn't happen at each call site. And that's where people pay the price in Smalltalk for all the fancy capabilities, is you know, the possibility that you could do something polymorphic at every call site. And what StrongTalk does, or type feedback, I should say, which, as I said, started with self, is says, hey, you only have to pay that cost when you really need it, which is when you're doing polymorphic things. When you have simply the potential of polymorphism, but that you don't use at each call site, then you don't pay the cost. And the way that is done is by running the code in the interpreter, measuring the different call sites, and then determining, hey, you know, 90% of these call sites, these integer operations, these control structures, et cetera, only use one receiver type. And then you can start inlining with a trap, and this is where it gets tricky, is you have to be able to de-optimize. That's where type feedback becomes very difficult, and it's the reason why you don't see it all over the place. Is it's easy enough to measure, you know, what classes occur at a call site. That's not terribly difficult. The difficult thing is optimizing for what's happened in the past, yet still being able to deal with it in the future if suddenly it becomes polymorphic. And you need to be able to back out of a compiled method right in the middle, at the point at which a call suddenly receives a different receiver type, and then you have to convert compiled frames, which are all inline together, back into interpreted frames. And that's really why this was such a difficult technology to do, and why the VM is so complicated. But the upside is, of course, that you can inline the vast majority of message sends. You can inline over 90% of message sends, and that's why you can finally do a good set of optimizations on the code.
Could I ask if anybody ever did any work on doing the same sort of thing for memory shape?
Sorry, say that again?
Doing the same sort of dynamic optimization for memory shape. So identifying that a certain structure is always in a certain size, and therefore you can make it more optimal.
You could do that. The problem is that I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to, but if you can do stack layout, stack allocation, then stuff like that would become very useful. When you put things on a heap, you know, the locations of things relative to each other are all over the place, and that would make that a bit more complicated, I think. The StrongTalk VM is able to do some kinds of stack allocation. Right now, that's limited to closures. You know, most of the closures that people end up having to have allocated on the heap that makes things like do slow in Smalltalk, those all get allocated on the stack in StrongTalk.
Though with enough inlining, you wouldn't need to worry about that, because the whole do should all be in one inlined method, which gives you the loop, which means you can apply an optimizer to it later.
Exactly. You can get the use of the block all the way down in, as it's passed down. You can get that inlined into the loop in which the closure is created, and then you can say, that, oh, with a little escape analysis, you can see that it doesn't go away.
To me, things get exciting when you can, at the point where you can get that do loop into a single big, fat, optimal method, and then start optimizing that, because now you've got the loop, and now you can move things out of it.
Exactly. That's why, I mean, you know, a lot of people have, you know, reacted skeptically to the claims that strong talk is so good relative to other small talks. It's not strong talk that's it's good. It's the type feedback is really good. It's a really wonderful technology. It is very complicated, but it does an extraordinarily much better job of letting you, you know, produce code that can be heavily optimized in small talk. I mean, for example, after all this inlining happens, we could even do other kinds of stack allocation. Any kind of object that is allocated temporarily, passed down through some methods and used without being stored in the heap could theoretically be stack allocated. And in other small talks, those things are not doable because they're not inlined into the same method. But in a large, you know, there's so much inlining going on in strong talk that I'm sure there's lots of opportunities to do that kind of stuff. Unfortunately, no one's done it yet. But we've got all the inlining done. Now somebody just needs to go and do it to the compiler.
Or just look at, say, an at, which is an array access for the non-small talkers. You've got an at. It's in the middle of a loop. The loop's formed by higher-order functions, i.e. your do. But to optimize it fully, you need to know that it's in a loop so you can do the loop arrange check once for the entire loop, which you can do if it's a normal traversal. That involves serious optimization, but after you've done the type feedback thing, you can do it in a purely dynamic environment.
Exactly, and that's another example of the, you know, the kinds of optimizations that type feedback enables that you just wouldn't be able to do otherwise. But what's interesting is, you know, even though strong talk is as fast as it is, it's not even doing range check elimination yet. You know, so there's all these low-hanging fruit that are just still waiting for additional speed-ups in strong talk. We need to do stack allocation. We need to do range check removal. We did do that in the Java VM, so I know it works, and I know it works with type feedback. Or with an inlining VM, I should say. But that's one of the things that we never got around to. So that's a nice optimization. It's just sitting there waiting for people to get at it one of these days.
Sorry, what happens if you have a method that does actually have a lot of polymorphism and it does switch back and forth between many different classes of objects in its calls? Does that cause a problem for strong talk?
Well, here's the way to think about it. When you actually do a dynamic dispatch, or a particular call site is going back and forth to different kind of receiver classes over time, you know, that's real work that's being done. That's real computation that has to be performed. And it's pretty hard for a compiler to get rid of real computation. What a compiler does is get rid of excess or redundant computation or computation that's not needed. And you can think of a dispatch as being something that is either needed or not. If it's a real polymorphic dispatch, then it's doing real work that you actually want it to do, and it has to do a lookup, and it has to detect different classes. And so strong talk can't inline, you know, what we call megamorphic sense, where a particular call site, you know, has 100 or 200 or 1,000 different receiver classes. But that's just something that's, you know, it doesn't make sense to inline that many versions.
That said, with type feedback, you could do that, but you'd want to delay it as long as possible because it's going to produce a lot of code. You're effectively creating a very big case statement, and if previous execution indicates that a very big case statement is the right way to implement that megamorphic send, you could put that quite easily into that kind of dynamic type feedback framework.
You certainly could.
It does have the ability to do some sort of cases on types then. For not megamorphic systems, but at least slightly polymorphic, maybe 5 or 10 call possible call locations.
Yes, that's something that could be done. What happens in practice, however, is that those kind of situations tend not to be the performance bottlenecks. If you actually, people are all surprised at this. People think that their code is a lot more polymorphic than it actually is. If you actually do the measurements on the code and look at each call site, you'll find out that, you know, it's actually quite a small fraction of the sends that are actually are polymorphic at all, and most of the ones that are polymorphic have just a couple classes or thousands, and then you see nothing in between. So it's very unusual to see something that has a polymorphism of, say, you know, 40 or 50 or something like that.
Yeah, and that doesn't surprise me.
We have other ways of getting rid of polymorphism. One other technique that's used in the VM is called customization, another self technique, and that means you basically copy methods down through inheritance. So what happens is that, for example, if you have a method up in, say, collection, and all the subclasses of collection say self to get at that method, well, if you had that method up just up in collection, that's a polymorphic send, right? Because there's all these different subclasses that are calling that. But if you actually copy a version of that method down into each leaf class, then suddenly it's no longer polymorphic. It becomes monomorphic because it always sends to self, and self is always a constant, and it's always the receiver class. And so suddenly all self-sends can be inlined without any type tests and without any polymorphism. So when you get these features interacting, you reduce the polymorphism of a lot of calls. A lot of things that would be polymorphic in other small talks become monomorphic. And then once you do the inline, you get additional levels of that. A good example of that is double dispatching. What often happens in people's code is they send a message to some object, and then they pass themselves in as an argument, or themselves and some other objects. And then that method then sends messages back to the arguments, which may be the caller, for example. And then you may get a round of messages that go back and forth and back and forth between these objects. Now, if this is done in a way that the type feedback can determine is monomorphic or slightly polymorphic, then it all gets inlined. And what happens is the self sends or the sends back to the caller, because they're already inlined into the calling method, the dispatch completely goes away. There aren't any checks that go on. So, for example, when you add two numbers together, like two doubles or something like that, you can say, oh, the receiver is a double. I'm going to pass in this other argument as the argument. And then the method in the double says, okay, I'm going to send a message back to my argument saying thus and such, and then they can have an interaction. Now, in fact, the VM optimizes the cases for doubles and integers, although that actually is done by type feedback. That's not a particularly good example, actually, because it only goes back and forth once. When you have a bunch of back and forth, what you see is cumulative kind of synergistic effect where a lot of the calls in the methods that become inlined become monomorphic because they're being copied into the caller. And so it's a very complicated thing. You have to look at a particular piece of code, but the end result is that you end up inlining a lot more stuff than you would think that you inline. If you just look at the source code and think about that as a single method floating around the system, it may look polymorphic to you. Once you inline that method into subclasses or inline it into callers, you know, once again, like I said, that decreases the polymorphism.
I've got a two-part question, and it's basically the same question but with a different receiver. How does all this technology and StrongTalk relate to the AOSTA project, and how does it relate to what you're doing, Bryce?
Okay, if I'm answering first, Exupre is really based on two strong influences. One is Urs's work in self, and the other is modern classical optimization. What I'm trying to do is put the two together. So I'm building a compiler that's based on heavily on the same influences, but I'm building it in a high-level language because I'm planning on doing very heavy-duty optimization later. So it's trying to take it one step further than self did and put in the really heavy optimization to take it that step further than self got to.
Okay. And so how does StrongTalk relate to the AOSTA project then?
Well, the interesting question is who's going to take that question.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's where we need Andres Falut on the call.
Well, for what little I know from talking to Elliot Miranda, you know, I think a lot of people, including Bryce and anybody who's really looked deeply into compiling Smalltalk, you know, really does hark back to Urs's type feedback work. Really was a big breakthrough, and it's going to, you know, it's going to be something that people are going to look to for the next generation of optimizations. And I think Elliot agrees with that, and I think probably Bryce does too, what he's saying. And, you know, there's different approaches to how to do that. And I think, like I said, I think the AOSTA project was really motivated by seeing that StrongTalk worked and that it was something that was a valid technology for Smalltalk, and also seeing that the self project worked and that it was really ready for someone to do an implementation of it.
The thing with AOSTA is it's trying to build on top of the VisualWorks VM, which is a solid, mature, commercial-grade VM that's ported to multiple platforms, and it's trying to add to that. So he's working all the same ideas in, but trying to keep all the low-level cross-platform work and the very tunable garbage collector and bring these ideas in on top.
Yes, I think it's very interesting how the three different approaches are taking a slightly different tack. The StrongTalk, you know, VM, because it was based on the self VM, and because we were, you know, a small startup trying to produce something and make some money and survive as a company, we simply felt, because of, you know, risk reasons, we just couldn't afford to throw out the entire source base from the self VM and start from scratch, for example, in Smalltalk or something. I really like the idea of doing a VM in Smalltalk, and I'm a big fan of that way to do it. But the problem is that it's a little bit more of a research project because there's some tricky issues involved. And so we just felt like we couldn't take that risk when we started StrongTalk. Now, you know, Bryce is going ahead and taking that risk, which is great. You know, it would be wonderful if we can get these technologies written in Smalltalk. And then with Elliot, it was a similar issue in terms of needing portability, which we couldn't do with the self-VM off the top of our heads.
But I'm writing it in Smalltalk, so I've got a lot more leverage in programmer time compared with writing in, say, C or C++. I don't feel I could take the risk of starting this project, the Exuperate project, in C or C++ because I don't have the developer resource to do it. You had Urs, which makes the risks of doing it there a lot less than for me.
Absolutely. No, I agree. I think, you know, I mean, there's a different risk, you know, associated with each approach. The risk we took was dealing with a very large, complex C++ code base. And
but you had somebody who knew it very well,
exactly.
Which reduces those risks greatly.
Yes, okay. I totally agree.
I got another question. In terms of Smalltalk optimizing VMs and the JVM hotspot technology, is hotspot still state of the art compared to what's happening in the Smalltalk VMs?
You mean the Java VM versus what? StrongTalk or?
Well, StrongTalk and VisualWorks and etc.
Well, yeah, the issue with any VM is development resources, and the reason why, you know, Java is at a level of maturity that it is because of the enormous attention that it's gotten and funding from a corporate sponsor, Sun, who was able to, you know, start a whole division and dedicate it to fleshing out that language and the VM and the libraries and keeping it as a single standard and all that stuff. You know, Smalltalk doesn't really have that luxury. But the JVM, the hotspot JVM, is very sophisticated at this point. The most difficult part of it is something that we haven't even talked about, which is making the VM internally thread safe so that it's internally multi-threaded. And that's an enormously difficult piece of work, which, for example, on multi-core systems or big server systems, is a big factor, but is very, very difficult. And that kind of work, I don't believe, has been done in any of the Smalltalk VMs yet. I don't know if VisualWorks does true simultaneous multi-threading, but I doubt it. I don't think any Smalltalk VM does, including StrongTalk.
Now, VisualWorks VM is not multi-threaded, even other than being able to spawn off threads for external API calls. And as I've had it explained to me numerous times by the VM team, that would be a difficult thing to do, and making the VM multi-threaded in that fashion would probably be a multi-year project, and the first iteration of it may well not be, you know, the problem I've always had with it as a product manager has been that I've been told numerous times by the people who, you know, would theoretically do it, bear in mind that the first generation of that might well be less stable than what we have now, just as we work out all the kinks in true multi-threading.
You would have to change your write barrier in your garbage collector, so it'd be a decent re-engineering of your garbage collector, which is mature, solid, tunable, great for something to build on top of. It uses a remembered set, which is not something that's easy to make multi-threaded.
That's actually why I've said, from my standpoint, it seems far less risky for us at a product level to say, make it easier to use multiple images and thus leverage multiple processes than try to make the VM multi-threaded, because it seems less risky from a development perspective.
And if you're architecting something to scale, you really want it to scale across multiple boxes. As soon as you want to buy 10 or 20 or 100 or 1,000 CPUs, you discover that it's a lot cheaper if you can buy them in lots of small boxes, even if they're now 4-8 processor boxes rather than one processor box.
But they're talking about 64 core chips now, so that's 64 CPUs in a single box. And that, I mean, no, yeah, I mean, we're hedging bets here. That doesn't necessarily mean that's the way things are going to continue to go, and it might be a giant flop and no one ever picks it up. But that's what the industry is talking about.
The greatest number of independently running threads is 8, which is Niagara. They say 32, but that's only because they're running more than one thread on an individual pipeline. So that if one thread stalls, the CPU's got another thread that it can swap in.
But of course, there's
only one can run it at a time.
And, of course, there's also things like Azul Systems with their, you know, massive numbers of processors for Java. And their VM they're using is actually based on the Hotspot Java VM, a modified version of it. That, like I said, when we went to Sun, we spent, you know, several years doing almost nothing but making the VM multi-threaded. It was an enormous project. And that's kind of what we, you know, we disappeared into a black hole after we got acquired by Sun, and that was the black hole, was doing all that engineering work. It was very hard, and, you know, it's not something that is can be casually done to any VM.
Okay, I've got another question then. To our friends over at Microsoft, how does their new .NET technology relate to everything we've been talking about?
Well, it's interesting. You know, .NET, in terms of compilation technology, it has some nice aspects to it. It can produce pretty good code because it does register allocation ahead of time, which is a nice feature. And it's got, you know, a much weaker security model than, say, Java, but something that's more flexible for different kinds of languages. But it's really got this fundamental issue, which I think they're struggling with now, but I don't know, I haven't heard of any magic bullet yet that they produced, in terms of dynamic languages, which I think you guys are aware of. You know, when you compile to a language that an intermediate language that was really designed for C and C++-like languages, it's pretty hard to compile Smalltalk as efficiently as something like Strongtalk does to that model. The big problem is that it's not dynamic. Or I believe they have been adding some dynamic features slowly to it, but if you can't do the ability to instrument your code and then later produce an inline form and then have that code be able to trap and unwind itself to a deoptimized form later so that you can do the kind of deoptimization that's necessary for type feedback, you're just not going to be able to get even close to the speed that you could get with type feedback.
We here at CINCOM, we had some of our Object Studio engineers specifically go look at the CLR as a potential environment for Object Studio, since Object Studio is a Windows-specific product. And they went as far as writing a prototype of Object Studio that would function partially, at least on the CLR. And the reason that was abandoned and that we decided instead to re-implement Object Studio on top of the VisualWorks VM was that they were just getting they were going to pay a performance penalty that they didn't think they'd have to pay if they went to VisualWorks. They thought going to VisualWorks they would get faster performance, whereas going to the CLR, even though Object Studio is a fully interpreted environment, they were effectively going to remain in an interpreted environment because they were going to have to write their whole interpreter environment on top of the CLR due to the lack of the stuff you guys are talking about.
It depends in fact, what you want to do, because if you want to make lots of calls into CLR code, you might be better off running an interpreter that makes those calls very fast. If you want to run a lot of code inside the language you're working in, then you want that language to run fast.
What's interesting is that that one of the places where CLR is least suitable, or has been in the past least suitable for languages like Smalltalk, is the way it does dispatches. You know, Smalltalk has always done dispatches based on inline caching, which is just a wonderful idea. And inline caching works for the same reason that type feedback works, which is that most calls are monomorphic. Most calls have a receiver type that's the same as it was the last time you made that call. And that's a form of self-modifying code, and it's based on having code that adapts. And that's just incompatible with that kind of code model they have. Now, I've noticed something very interesting, which is that apparently Microsoft has recently changed the way they do dispatch in the CLR to use something that looks just like inline caching. It's very strange. I don't think they're doing it in mono yet, but it looks like they've actually realized that inline caching is actually a more efficient way to do dispatch than the traditional C++ virtual call kind of way of doing it, which is what they did in the past. And so what's interesting is the CLR is actually doing a little bit of self-modifying code internally now to patch the call to the most recent receiver type. What's interesting to me is that actually means it's gathering enough type information that you could potentially inline monomorphic calls.
Now, is the Java VM any better than the CLR for languages like Smalltalk and for the kinds of optimizations you're talking about?
Probably not. You know, the big problem with the Java VM is the same problem with the CLR. Once you have a VM that is highly tuned for a particular language model or a group of languages, then, you know, you're always cutting out languages that are much different. It makes it much more difficult. You know, with the Java VM, the biggest problem is the fact that all dispatch is based on classes, which are not necessarily there in Smalltalk, so you have to do dispatch differently. And the other giant problem is that there are no tagged types. So integers are not a tagged thing that can be used polymorphically with, you know, other kinds of objects. And so to mimic that behind the scenes involves boxing or all sorts of hellish tricks. You'd really ideally need to trick the garbage collector into treating those things right, but that's not possible because you're working on top of a black box VM. So in terms of tagging and dispatch both, those are very difficult problems that are always going to keep you from doing a high-performance Smalltalk VM on top of the Java VM.
That was always my impression as well. And there's been some talk in the Java community about a new invoke dynamic bytecode, but I don't think that it would have enough of a benefit for Smalltalk to make it justifiable, Smalltalk on top of the JVM.
Well, not only that, it seems to me that most of that talk, and I've seen this both in the Microsoft environment and the Java environment, it seems like the people talking about getting dynamic languages running in those environments specifically are talking about scripting languages and Glue rather than full application development. They're more interested in doing a little bit of scripting here and a little bit of scripting there in order to optimize the Glue process of various things together. They're not really talking, at least not that I can see, about writing whole applications in a dynamic language, because I guess at the base of it, they just don't believe that that's the right way to do things.
Well, you can write whole applications in them. The Python people and the Ruby people do. You just don't write heavy-duty number crunching.
Oh, no, no, that's...
code isn't number crunching.
Oh, I understand that. I understand that. I'm just saying, mentally speaking, if you look at the way that those communities talk, that's I think, the standpoint they come at it with, is what I'm saying.
Agreed.
Well, that's all been very interesting, honestly. That was very educational. But what was this call to arms to make all small talks use the Strongtalk VM about?
Well, basically, it comes from the fact that we're in a very strange situation with Strongtalk here. None of us, me included, thought this would be happening. I gave up Strongtalk years ago. It's something from the distant past. One of the strange things that's always been a part of the Smalltalk world has been this feeling of being from the distant past and yet still being better than the state of the art. Smalltalk's been around for a long, long time, and yet it's still better than the languages that most people are using out there. And Strongtalk had a similar thing where, 10, 15 years ago, it was state-of-the-art technology and better than any other compilation technology for dynamic languages. And here we are 10 or 15 years down the road, and it still is better. So for me, this was a big struggle as to what to do about Strongtalk. When it was released from Sun, there was a big fear that, hey, here's something that nobody's touched for 10 years, but it's a wonderful thing that shouldn't be lost. I mean, this was something that people have been wanting for a long time, and a lot of people, including me, were very sad to see it kind of disappear into sitting on a shelf at Sun. And so the question is, how can we best, have this technology survive and get some use in the Smalltalk community? And, I'm off doing other things. I'm not working on Strongtalk. I mean, how many open source projects do you know of have no one working on them? it doesn't normally happen like this where something is state-of-the-art, yet people stopped working on it years ago. So I'm facing this difficult issue of...
Have a look at Postgres, which is a similar position, or was, when it was originally released. I forget the name of the guy, but it was a research grade, the second research grade relational database by that team. The first one was Ingres.
Right.
And it was abandoned, and then it was picked up, and then they had to bring this thing into something that could be managed by a team of part-timers.
Right, and so what we're facing here, what I was facing, was, gee, how can we make this thing happen? Just like you guys all, I've got other things that I'm doing as my primary activities. And so the question is, if nobody's going to work on this full-time, how can Strongtalk survive? And the biggest problem, of course, is the VM, because the VM isn't something like a normal Smalltalk application where any competent Smalltalk programmer can kind of get in there and figure out how it works. It's something that requires very, specialized knowledge and a lot of, work and dedication to, learning how it's put together. It's got its own way of doing things. My fear was, hey, if we can't get some decent group of people in the Smalltalk community behind this stuff, it's just going to, just sit here on a shelf and the release won't have meant anything to anybody. So basically that call to arms was my effort to try to, get some people working on it, because here we've got an incredible opportunity. There's nobody pushing this. I'm not pushing this. I'm doing other stuff. I'm just trying to save it so that people can use it somehow. I get the feeling that people think that there's a Strongtalk team or that I'm spending all my time on this, and it's not true. If we can't somehow as a community figure out how to do something with this technology, it's just going to go nowhere. And so I was trying to mobilize people to realize, hey, this is an asset that we all have as a community. It's not a commercial product. It's not, you know, something from a group of people that have an agenda. It's sitting out there waiting to get some love. I was trying to point out to people, hey, this is a unique event in the history of Smalltalk. It's the first time a completely open source with no commercial restrictions on the license, high performance VM that's, you know, got this radical technology is just sitting there waiting to be picked up. And the problem is that, you know, everybody is making rational decisions based on, you know, the paths they've chosen. The Squeak people and Bryce and Syncom are all doing the things that are, you know, they have to do based on the paths they've chosen and the history of their VMs and their approach. And unfortunately, all those rational decisions have led the Smalltalk community into this sort of fractured state. And it's a hard one to solve. I mean, everyone's making, you know, the right decisions for them. And the end result has been that, you know, we're all working on different VMs, different versions of the language. And to me, that's kind of sad. I just saw Strongtalk as an opportunity for us to finally all jump over onto, you know, a really, really hot VM that's already working. But like I said, I understand, you know, Bryce has got, for example, other motivations, which is to do a VM in Smalltalk, which I think is an admirable thing, and I would love to see that happen. I just really feel like the Smalltalk community had a chance to kind of pull together, but unfortunately, I think my call to arms was taken more as, you know, jump on my agenda, which was not my intent. I just really was trying to get people to help out because I can't do it by myself.
Thank you very much. It was very interesting chatting, and it's clear we can feel your passion for it, and I'm sure everyone will get that, and I hope something does happen with the technology.
The other thing is StrongTalk's got more than just the VM. It's also got the type system.
Yes, there are many different things that we thought were innovative in StrongTalk. I mean, I'm trying to figure out where can we best spend our time to get some of that out for people to use. I've been afraid that with just me working on it, you know, probably all that I'm going to have time for is getting the VM stable and work towards getting it ported.
The key thing is a couple of people getting interested and jumping on, and you can never tell what's going to interest people. And when people get interested and jump on and actually start doing something.
Right. And to sum up where I think you're going to see StrongTalk going, hopefully, is this. You know, it's sat around for 10 or 15 years and been state-of-the-art. So time is not as much of a worry as it is for some projects. If it takes a couple years for StrongTalk to get robust in terms of the VM and get ported, that's not going to be the end of the world because it's still going to be state-of-the-art in a couple years.
Well, the type system could jump to another dialect or...
Yeah, Ruby or Python.
Exactly. There's many things that could happen. So what I'm doing is, given the limited resources, given the fact that at the moment there isn't really a group of people that can jump on the VM and help out, even though I believe a lot of people would like to. So my feeling is I'm going to take what little time I can have to spend on it and try to dedicate that to laying the groundwork so that people can jump on later by, you know, getting the VM more stable, getting it ready to be ported, and building up a base of VM documentation and knowledge so that if people want to jump on, they can.
I know from my experience, people really jumped in after a port was done to Solaris x86 of all platforms. Patrick did a port to that, and then that, I think, helped trigger the port to Windows, which is a massive step forward for Exuperate. But it just involved somebody doing something, then somebody else seeing it and doing something that has a lot more practical benefit. I mean, we've got how many Solaris x86 users compared with how many Windows people? But it was the Solaris x86 people that triggered it. I mean, you never quite know what's going to cause that thing to happen.
Right. And so hopefully you'll see happen here is just slow progress in terms of getting a StrongTalk position so that people can do something with it, and the people who want to jump on and help can do that at some point.
And also build bridges between the dialects so that good ideas and good work can move around easily.
Absolutely. Just wanted to say it's really nice to have several open source small talks out there now. It's a really nice feeling.
Yeah, it's good to see. Thank you very much, David, for your time.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time with us.
Thanks, David, Bryce.
And we'll see you next time.
All right.
See you.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Bye.
Stay tuned. Next up is James Savage with this week's Smalltalk Jobs Report for the week of Sunday, January 14th.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. Sydney, Australia, Temp Team in Active Selection still has multiple positions for Smalltalk developers with good communication skills. Bethesda, Maryland. Trilogy Technology Services, LLC, is looking for a development team leader that has experience with project management and SDLC. Smalltalk, insurance knowledge, and Java are considered pluses. This position pays $85,000 to $95,000 per year. Minneapolis, Minnesota. Precision Systems Design is looking for a senior Smalltalk developer who has good communication skills and experience with OOAD and SQL. This is for a 6-month contract. Contractors that work through Precision System Design will get 80% of the bill rate. Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Precision System Designs is looking to fill a permanent junior programmer analyst position. They are looking for experience with SSL, OOAD, XML, and relational databases, WSDL, SOAP, and HTML. Smalltalk and a mathematics background are considered pluses. San Francisco, California, or Minneapolis, Minnesota. Line Beyond is looking for a Smalltalk developer that has experience with QA, SQL Server, and Microsoft development tools. Java is considered a plus. Sacramento, California. Robert Half Technology is looking for an experienced Smalltalk developer. About this contract position, Patrick Kirk wrote the following in the Comp Lang Smalltalk News Group. Quote, I have a client in Sacramento, California that is looking for an experienced Smalltalk developer to come in and help them make some progress on the work they have done so far. Name your price. But they are looking for a senior level, if not expert, on Smalltalk. They have programmers that are working with it now and are familiar, but they would like to have a very senior level person on staff. End quote. These are just a few examples of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that podcast with David Griswold, David Bach, Bryce Campcheese, and Michael Lucas Smith and I. Next week, Industry Misinterpretations will be on a brief hiatus, as I will be in Disney World on vacation. However, I will have a podcast for that week. If you recall, back in December, I did an interview with a product management website where I discussed my usage of RSS, Atom, and syndication technology. I will be pushing that interview out as next week's podcast. Until then, I'll see you on the road.
Darling, I gotta talk to you about the things you've been putting me through now. I gotta talk to you, I gotta be explained to you.